everybody. I'm Gola. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since December 29th, 2018. That's just a little over 6.5 years. My sponsor is Chris Clark, and my home group is the Pacific Group. I want to thank Mark for inviting me to be here with all of you. I want to thank all of you for giving me such a warm welcome. It is always a relief for me to walk a threshold in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you're new, I want to welcome you. You don't necessarily have to feel that way yet, but I hope that you do come to feel that way with us, that this is a safe place for you. And if you hear nothing else, what I want you to know really is, above all else, what I've found here is absolute freedom and a new way of life, similar to the way that Richard talked about. And I needed to hear that when I was new, because I really was not interested in physical sobriety per se. You seemed to have something figured out here, and that I'd always been perplexed by, and that was how to live. And I wanted to figure out whatever you were doing to do that so well, and then go on my merry way and continue drinking like the lady I always had been, although I'd never been one. But if you're new, please stay. I hope that you find those things here. I implore you to take the experiment of the 12 steps. You know, at worst, things will be different. And then you can go on your merry way if you choose to. I haven't, and I love it here. I've been taught to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and that is what I'm going to endeavor to do with you. What it was like is, I've just always been a weird kid. I'm still a weird kid. I'm 32, and I'm still a weird kid. And I am a lot more comfortable with that today as a result of the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and also being a part of a secret society of weirdos with all of you as well. And you know, I think, like, my core belief, my first conscious thought is, like, something's wrong in there. Something's wrong in there. And I didn't have the words for it, but I just knew that whatever you were doing, whatever you had inside you, however you were living, I was incapable of. And, you know, those feelings predated my, you know, acknowledgement that, yeah, circumstantially, I grew up in a different environment than my fellows. My parents are immigrants. I have a weird name. English is not my first language. I grew up in an affluent area of Los Angeles, and I was in the apartment that had eviction notices on the door. You know, like, they had help in their houses, and we had like an old Toyota 4Runner that ran sometimes. And my parents divorced when I was 3. It was super contentious. And from a young age, I was this, you know, mediator and messenger between 2 fully grown adults. And then I'd go to school, and I'd be made fun of for my name and the way that I dressed and the way that I talked. And then I'd come home to this very critical mom. And it just felt like there was no friendly place for me. And it felt like everything externally confirmed for me what I internally knew to be true. And that is that I was just built wrong. I am wrong. And, you know, there was alcohol present in my home life. What I observed that to look like was that it would transport 2 typically pretty stressed out adults into 2 people that could dance with their friends and sing with their friends and experience joy. And I didn't have the language as a child to say, you know, I want to get drunk. But whatever that feeling was, I wanted desperately, because from a young age, I had these big feelings of depression and anxiety and fear. And I remember begging my mom in the morning to just not let me stay home. Please let me stay home. I can't go do it again, because it feels like everyone got there the day before I did and learned all the lessons, right, about how to make friends and how to connect and how to talk. And I just missed that day, and I'm going to be behind from the very beginning. So I don't remember what my first drink is, because I experimented with drinking a lot of weird ways. As a kid, I would steal my dad's beer. I would drink my mom's wine. And I did not care for the taste, so I never drank enough to feel the effect produced by alcohol until I was 14. My first drunk that I can remember is 9 shots of Bacardi rum at age 14. I just saw a guy mouth yuck. It was terrible. But for me, it was life-changing. You know, I was with a group of kids that from Venice, and I was from Santa Monica, and Santa Monica was very lame, and Venice was so cool and punk rock, and I just wanted so desperately to be like them. And, you know, I felt the effect produced by alcohol after about 2 or 3 shots, and what that was for me, I always equate to being my very first spiritual experience. I never want to over-equate what that means for anyone. You know, I like going off of one of the ways that it's reframed in our literature. There's an appendix on spiritual experience, and it reframes that idea for people like me that don't want to talk to you about spirituality when I get here. And my favorite way it's simplified really is that a spiritual experience can be as simple as a profound alteration in my reaction to life. And in short, that's what the effect produced by alcohol does for me. It profoundly alters my perception of life. So when I feel the effect produced at age 14 after those two or three shots, what that looks like for me is that, you know, I don't get taller, I don't get blonder, I don't change into anything other than myself, but that monologue that is always going in my head that is asking, you know, do they think I'm smart, do they think I'm pretty, do they think I'm funny, am I holding my hands the right way, should I lean into the conversation, should I lean out from the conversation, that goes quiet. And the effect produced by alcohol allows me the ability to be here now in the moment with you comfortably and to suddenly get it, what everyone else is doing to do life. And, you know, if I was naturally incapable of doing that, and alcohol provided the ability to do that, problem, solution, end of story. But the problem for me is that if two or three shots feels like that, what is nine shots going to feel like? Let's take that experiment. So from my very first drunk, there was never a line that I crossed. It was off to the races, send it fully. I'm going to push it to the limit every single time because this thing gives me this sense of belonging, this sense of rightness within me that I desperately long for, that I had experienced in some ways, you know, whether it was acting or singing or creating, because that's what I loved as a kid, but it was so much more gradual. But alcohol and the effect produced by alcohol provided it with an immediacy that made everything make sense in a way that I desperately needed it to when it came to life. You know, prior to that, I said that there was alcohol in my home environment. My mom was a heavy drinker when I was growing up. I don't know if she's one of us. That's her, you know, decision and diagnoses to make. But when I was around age 10, she would, you know, leave me at home quite a bit so that she could stay out drinking. And I would, you know, be this 10-year-old kid that was wondering, you know, when is my mom going to come home? Is she going to come home? Is she going to be able to drive safely down to Topanga Canyon and not, you know, fly off a cliff or something? And after time in AA and you know, the repairing that the 12 steps does to my heart but does to the relationships in my life, I've come to find a forgiveness for that. But I never want to minimize, like, how terrifying that was for a child and how much there was a piece of me that promised that I would never make anyone else feel like that. But then I discovered alcohol, right? And it's almost as if, like, it made sense why that was the priority above all else. And so that's what it became in my life. You know, as soon as I knew what alcohol did for me and to me, I was a binge drinker whenever it was available. By the age of 17, I was an everyday drinker and I got alcohol poisoning. And what that night looked like was six kids doing a beer run to, you know, Gelson's or whatever it was, and somehow meandering out of that store with three big bottles. And the alcoholic in the group said, "I'll just take this one, guys. Don't worry." And it was a bottle of passion fruit Smirnoff, and I had a carton of passion fruit Kern's juice. And God, the combination was magic. And it's like I couldn't taste anything. And so what I remember is that we started at the beginning of this long alleyway in Santa Monica. We started drinking, and by the end of that alleyway, my last memory was me taking the bottle and throwing it and it shattering into pieces, and then I just blacked out. And the next thing I remember is waking up in the emergency room and having a kind nurse guide me to the restroom, and then I blacked out. And then the next thing I remember is waking up in my bed the next morning, activated charcoal all over me from the times they had pumped my stomach. And, you know, I was given an ultimatum at that time by my mom that either I can get my act together or I can go live with my dad. And for me, the choice is really simple. Anytime you put something in between me and my ability to drink, I am going to choose alcohol, right? But that is not how it appeared to me at age 17. How it appeared to me at age 17 was not that alcohol was beginning to make decisions for me. It appeared to me that, you know, how dare she make me make this choice? Doesn't she know that this is the thing I need to fix what she broke? I can't take any accountability from the minute alcohol is introduced into my life. And you know, in those three short years, when I began drinking, alcohol produced an effect that was so elusive that I didn't even have to drink to feel some degree of relief. I could just know that there was a drink in the future. I could be at school on a Thursday and I could be romancing the drink for Friday night, planning it out, where we were going to go, what we were going to drink, how we were going to get it. And it was like, oh, yeah, I can get through anything if that's going to be in my future. But in 3 short years, right, around that time that I got alcohol poisoning, it was as if I wasn't actively drinking, if I wasn't actively drunk, those feelings of depression, those feelings of fear, those feelings of anxiety were back on top of me, those feelings of suicidal ideation and saying, you know, you're not built for this. And so, you know, I didn't get very far school-wise. And by my early 20s, I was just drinking for blackout. I was drinking to be as far away from here and as far away from now and as far away from you and the consequences of my drinking as possible. And that's not how it all began, right? And it just didn't matter to me. I had all of these cool opportunities professionally that I squandered entirely because all that mattered to me was that I had this bar at the end of my street that I would still drive to for some reason. But they knew my name. My drink was ready for me when I walked in. They let me stay after last call with the bartenders. And I really thought, if this is as good as it ever gets, like, I don't need anything else. It was my cheers. And, like, I just wanted that, right? And, but, you know, I used to say for a while into sobriety that I didn't realize that my drinking was an issue because a lot of people around me drank the way that I drank. But by age 23, you know, I had like 2 friends, 3 friends. And of that group, one has since committed suicide and the other died of cirrhosis of the liver at age 29. So we find our people, whether we're here or out there. And I think I certainly did. And the person that came to the conclusion that my drinking might be an issue was a partner that I had who saw the wreckage I would create when I was drinking, and he began to start to control and manage my drinking for me. And what that would look like is that we would go out, and he'd say, "We're going to go out, and you're going to have 2 drinks tonight." And I'd say, "Okay, we're going to go out, and I'm going to have 2 drinks tonight." And I said that not because I thought I had an issue with drinking in any way, but because, one, insulting. Yeah, I could have 2 drinks. Watch me. And two, because whether or not I thought I had a problem, I could concede that my drinking at the very least and the way that I was when I was drunk was affecting this relationship that of a sane and sober mind I really claimed to care about. So yeah, sure, I'll limit myself. But what would happen for me when we went out is I would have that 2-drink allotment, and suddenly the thought would occur to me of, you know, why did I ever make that promise? Like, surely I can have one more and it won't hurt. And so I'm slipping off to the bar and I'm taking shots behind his back, or his friends are slipping me drinks, and again, I'm just drinking for oblivion, and I'm waking up the next morning and I'm having to solve the great mysteries of life, like, where is my car? Why am I bleeding? Why is my phone broken? And then having stories recounted to me of the people that I pissed off and the fights that I started, whether physical or verbal, really just depended on the night, and the apologies that I now have to go and give, whether or not I actually think they deserve an apology. And it wasn't working, and it wasn't cute anymore, and I just didn't care. I just didn't care because I was so depressed when I wasn't drinking. And even at this point in my life, I began to be depressed when I was drinking. It's like everything that drinking used to suppress for me was now amplified every time I was drunk. It was coming out in these like gross emotional upheavals where I was fighting everyone and everything and mad at everyone and feeling like my life had just absolutely gone down the hole and it was everyone else's fault and I couldn't take any accountability for any of the life choices that I had made. My way of finally really, you know, beginning to hit bottom in a rather glorious fashion was building a rather intimate relationship with an alcohol propellant that, for our intents and purposes, I'll just call cocaine because that's what it was. And here's where I'll pause, because I have a tremendous respect for singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's one thing that unites us all here, and that is alcoholism and the relationship that we have with alcohol as abnormal drinkers. So if you are new or not so new and drugs are not a part of your story, it's absolutely not a requirement for you to be an alcoholic or a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm more so speaking to our newer friends that may feel like their experience with drugs may disqualify them from this program. And what I will say is that if you cannot stop when you honestly want to, and if you find that you cannot control your drinking when you are drinking, you may be an alcoholic. And I hope that you stay here long enough to do the 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book with someone who has done them before to recognize whether or not you may be one of us. Because if you are, I have really good news, right? There's a great solution that many of us have had access to and are happy to share with you.
I didn't want any of that the first time I got here. The first time I got here, I had told my partner about my little issue, and he had connected me with his best friend's dad, who was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had introduced me to some women who brought me to my first meeting. And, you know, they poured the love of AA upon me and gave me their numbers and called me and bought me a big book and told me about sponsorship and told me to get a sponsor. And I wanted none of it. I really just was not interested because I refused to look at my drinking at all, right? Like, the idea of complete abstinence seemed a little drastic. I could concede to you that, yeah, drugs are an issue. Of course they're an issue. Society tells me they're an issue. Like, the fact that I'm staying up for days on end, losing hair and not eating kind of feels like an issue. But I can't ever imagine a life without alcohol. Not even knowing that at that point that is some kind of an admission of powerlessness, right? Because years prior to that, I'd been given sufficient reason to stop. And I just wasn't willing to even look at that. So what I would do is I would sit in these meetings, I'd listen to your cute little stories, and I'd listen for every little thing that would disqualify me from being you. And I was 25 years old when I got here, and my life looked really good on paper. So when you told me about your DUIs and your lost jobs and your lost cars, I thought, okay, check, check, check. None of those things have happened for me yet, so I'm not one of you. You know, I had the job, the car, the apartment, the boyfriend. Everything looks really good on paper, so I'm not one of you. If consequences equal alcoholism, then I'm not an alcoholic. I couldn't humble myself to the degree of being honest with another human and tell them that I can't get out of bed without getting loaded. I can't take a shower. I can't get dressed. I can't get through a work day. But everything looks really good. So complete abstinence is off the table. And then you guys really wanted to talk about this whole God thing. And no thanks. I just really was this adamant atheist that grew up with an existentialist dad that told me God is dead from age 8. And I just thought, you know, it's really cute that you're simple enough for that to work for you, but I'm just a little too smart for that. And I'm a high school dropout, so I'm not too smart for that. But I really, really, it wasn't for me. I thought it was something that I already had a lot of antipathy for, and I wasn't interested. And so, you know, one of the ways that Dr. Bob is described in our literature when Bill first goes to meet him is that being painfully aware he was somehow abnormal, he did not yet know what it meant to be an alcoholic. That's me, right? Like, I think alcoholism needs to look like this or that, but I can't get down to the causes and conditions of my own drinking and relationship with drinking and recognize that my relationship with alcohol is fundamentally abnormal, but I'm painfully aware I'm somehow abnormal. And I need to go find that thing that's going to fix it, because this ain't it. So in the week that I leave AA, I lose my job, I lose my apartment, I lose my relationship. And I attempt suicide for the first of a couple times to come. And an intervention is done on me by my father and my boyfriend at the time. And these two men that I claim to love the most in life sit across from me and tell me that if I continue living the way that I'm living, that I'm going to die. And I look them in the eyes and I say, good. Because I'd rather die at this point than change anything about what I'm doing. And, you know, my mantra at that point really was like, the only person that I'm hurting is myself. And I can guarantee you that there's lists that I've had to go through, right, and go back and make amends for of people I hurt that I didn't even understand that I'd hurt during that period of my life, because I just didn't care either. I've come to care almost painfully too much. But anyways, the next 8 months of my life was like me writing my own more about alcoholism, all the methods I'd tried to control and manage my drinking. I put the drugs down and I just tried to drink. And I tried to go to therapy and I tried to go to psychiatry and I tried psychedelics because I hear they're really good for people with addiction. And I leave Los Angeles because I think just a change of environment is going to do it. And then I come back to Los Angeles for a different guy because he's going to know how to love me and then I'll be okay. And none of those things worked. In those last few months of drinking, two really important things happened. And one is that, you know, on that plane ride back from my last geographic, I told myself, I'm going to have a drink in the lounge. I'm going to have a drink on the plane. I'm going to watch a movie. I'll wake up in Los Angeles. Which, by the way, normal people don't do that. They don't go like, I'm going to plan out these drinks and this amount, because they don't have to, right? what happened in reality is that I had two drinks in the lounge. I started with two drinks on the plane. I met my new best friend right next to me, right? And then we talked for the entire 9-hour flight where I told him about how I'd conquered my addiction as we're, you know, sharing glasses of wine. And at some point, they stopped bringing me wine. And so I think, that's weird. And I get up and I go to the bathroom and I tell the stewardess, you know, if you don't mind just bringing me another glass. And she says, yeah, we think you might have had too much. And in that split second, right, I have two paths open up. And one of them is I can absolutely lose it on this person, but then there's no alcohol at the end of that path. So what do? I manipulate because I'm great at that. So I say, oh, yeah, no worries. How long do you want me to wait? And she said, 30 minutes. And so I went back to my seat and I set a timer and I stared at it for 30 minutes until I could order another glass of wine, which I did. The other really important thing that happened is that I was playing a lot of music back then, and I played this show that my friend was putting together, and it was a really important show, and a lot of people that I really loved were going to be there, and I told myself, you know, I'm absolutely not going to drink tonight. Then I got there, and I thought, you know, a thermos of wine won't hurt, a thermos. And I go and I fill it up, and that's how it starts, right? And then by the time it gets to my set time, which is it's supposed to be a 10-minute set, that somehow, I don't know how, extends to a 30-minute set, and I am like up there doing my fifth step for the audience, talking about my suicide attempts and my resentments. And to this day, there are people, because this was in my hometown, there are people that were there that night that if I see on the street, there's a bit of shame that pops up. No one should know that much about me and be able to still exist and not be my sponsor. And you know, in the month prior to getting sober, I was living in between my car and my friend's couches, and that was my choice, right? Like, I had a place to go, to my parents' homes, and I was for a while, but then this thing happened where this look of shame would be present when I'd come in the door drunk one more time after saying that tonight was going to be different, and rather than changing anything about my drinking, I thought it would be easier just to stop coming back. And I weighed 93 pounds. I couldn't put anything in my body besides alcohol and drugs. I had 48 cents in my bank account because I couldn't hold down a job without drinking through my shift. And like the cherry on top of everything was that I walked into a Floyd's barbershop at 10 p.m. one night and I asked them to shave my head. And that's how I came to you, bald, skeletal, and angry. And you know, at this point, I could concede that there was something that was not working in my life. I did not know that it was alcohol, but, you know, I am a strong-willed person, and I know how to arrange the pieces in my life just right so that I can justify my behavior and my drinking. So I think that tomorrow's going to be different. Tomorrow's going to be a new day. Tomorrow I'm going to get that job and that place, and everything's going to be okay. But then I wake up, and my head is screaming at me and telling me about all of the things I've already ruined and how nothing's ever worked out and how worthless I am and how I'll never amount to anything and I might as well get good and drunk now. And there were just days like that on repeat until all I could do at night was drink and take sedatives and other pills and hope that in the morning I wouldn't wake up. And when I did, I would curse the very God that I claimed not to believe in for letting me live one more day. What happened for me is that I walked into a bar one night trying to get someone to buy me a drink, and instead I met a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because God knows who to send me. And he 12-stepped me on Christmas Day of 2018. I was house-sitting for that man I met on the plane because there was something about that exchange that he found trustworthy, I guess. And I, you know, I was two bottles deep by 10 a.m., and I was calling people frantically to come and take care of me, and they wouldn't. And what they were willing to do was call the LAPD to come do a wellness check on me because they'd known about the suicide attempts. And, you know, LAPD came, and I was able to convince them I was just drunk and alone on Christmas. And they sat with me and waited for someone to come take legal responsibility of me. And they let me drink my wine and smoke my weed. And I was realized very quickly that they hadn't heard my sob story yet, so I told them, and I was just so excited to have these two new friends on Christmas. And, you know, my friend Kim, they left, she yelled at me, she left, and then I called this man, and, you know, the way that we do, he came over with his marching orders, and he had his big book, and he started reading to me from it, and with my very little knowledge of AA, I wanted none of what he was selling, and so I thought, you know, so glad that works for you, I'm a little different, and so he approached me the way that I wanted to be approached, and asked me what I wanted, and I told him that I just wanted somebody to listen, because I really thought that if someone understood every detail and nuance of my life, that there would be some freedom in feeling understood by somebody. And so we set a timer for 20 minutes, and I told him why it was my mother's fault and my ex's fault and everyone else's fault, and if everyone would do things my way, we'd all be a lot better off. And the timer went off, and he asked me if I felt better, and I said no. And so we set a timer for another 20 minutes. And, you know, at the end of that 40-minute breathless rant, like, one of those last good ideas that someone needs to hear this was gone. And of all the things I remember about that night, what I always like to point out is that I asked this man, like, why are you doing this? Because I am not used to anything but transactional relationships at this point in my life. Surely there's an ulterior motive. Surely, like, you're expecting something on the other end of this kindness. And he told me the most important thing, you know, I've ever heard and will ever hear, and I, Richard touched on it too, it's like helping me was part of his recovery. That's it. And so if you're new, please know that, you know, we want nothing from you. We want everything for you. Most of us are willing to do just about anything to help you experience a slice of what we've found here, provided that you're willing and able to take a few simple steps. And I fell into a 3-day blackout. I woke up on December 28th, 2018. I had to reach for something to shut off my brain, and it just wouldn't work anymore. And it was like, you know, some feeling of defeat, maybe even in hindsight, that if I had an ocean of alcohol right now, it still wouldn't be enough. And that delusion that I've been living by, that if I just drink long enough and hard enough, that feeling of ease and comfort that I felt with my first few drinks would come back, was just gone. And the most terrifying thing was that it would just never work again, and that I would always feel like this. And in that feeling of desperation, that feeling of brokenness, with no knowledge of prayer or experience with it or conception of a higher power or, you know, willingness to conceive of one, I talked to a ceiling and, you know, said the most profound and honest prayer I've probably ever said. And it was, you know, probably nothing more profound than help. And in Bill's story, there's this line that says, there was a humble willingness to have God with me, and he came. And that's my story. And, you know, I wasn't humble by virtue. I wasn't living a virtuous life at that point. But I had humiliated myself into absolute humility in an act of alcoholism. I had seen the result of my will in all my affairs. And I was completely defeated. Not just by alcohol, but by myself. And I called out for help, and I called my dad, and I told him I needed to get help, and I didn't want to come back to AA. I thought I might end up in like a nice treatment center in Malibu where I could pet horses until I was sober. And, you know, I don't come from a family that can afford that. I didn't even have health insurance at the time. But it just so happens that, you know, a friend of my mom and dad was sober. And when he was getting sober, my dad rescued him off of Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles and brought him home to detox on our couch. And we waited for his number to come up at Acton Rehab. And when it did, my mom drove him to rehab, and I was in the car 4 months old with them, visiting him in Acton. And when I got sober, that man owned a treatment facility, and he took me in for free. And if I ever doubt, you know, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous or the loving grace of a higher power, well before I was willing to receive it, that's one of the things I've always thought of, because it's always been there. And it took me a week of being there dry and miserable to realize to some degree that, like, simple physical separation from alcohol for an alcoholic of my type doesn't actually make anything better, because things got bad mentally. They got bad real quick. And, you know, I thought I was losing my mind, because you remove alcohol from me. Alcohol's been my only buffer to reality and my means of living, my design for living for 11 years at that point. So what do I do with myself? Medicate me. I'm so glad that no one did, because for me, my personal experience was I needed a sufficient substitute to alcohol, and where I found it was Alcoholics Anonymous, but I certainly didn't come here expecting that. I came here because I, after a week, had gotten bored of treatment, and needed another solution and needed a night out, and this sounded like a good one. And so I went to my first meeting of AA and of this sobriety, and you know, out of 3,000 meetings a week in Los Angeles at that point, I walked into a meeting where there was a girl that I'd known since I was 5 years old, and she was sober for 6 or 7 years at that point. And she looked like a different person. And I was intimately acquainted with what her drinking looked like because I drank with her. You know, we were the kind of kids that obsessed over drinking before we ever drank. And she was the girl you avoided at high school parties because she was so drunk, right? And I thought, okay, if something here is working for her to make her look that good, because I'm vain, let me figure it out. Because I feel like I'd benefit from that in my, you know, whatever. And it was a big book study that night where they were reading, working with others, and I got to see how I was 12-stepped in fine print, and that gave you guys some credibility. And after that meeting, I was surrounded by the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, women that gave me their numbers and told me to keep coming back. And in my 8-month recess from AA, I forgot that you did that for everyone here. I just thought me with my shaved head and my sober living chic was very special, and you need me for your meeting. And so, okay, I'll oblige. And so I followed those women to another meeting where the woman who became my first sponsor spoke. And it was there that I was given the gift of identification, and someone well armed with the facts of their own alcoholism stood at a podium and talked about how they drank and how they felt and how they thought and how they behaved and how they justified it all on the back of alcohol and the pursuit of more alcohol. And it was in that that I understood, or began to understand, that it's not me in explaining myself to you that I feel understood. It's in the gift of identification that is available to all of us here if we be alcoholic, of someone talking from a podium or just alcoholic to alcoholic imparting their experience, that I begin to identify as an alcoholic. I begin to sink deeper into my seat in these rooms and understand this new weird feeling I'm feeling is called safety. And I become more uniquely, I mean, time after time after time in 6.5 years, like, someone puts words to something that is happening in my brain that I don't have words for in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I'm a very satisfied customer. But, you know, I asked that woman to sponsor me. We got started on a course of rigorous action, which included me going to a meeting every day of the week that I drink, which consequently was every day. And, you know, taking a little job at those meetings to keep me accountable to continue attending them when I did not feel like it, because those nights happened. And I understood that, right? I understood that that would keep me accountable, but I did not understand that that would be the first place I'd start to build self-esteem in this world. That, like, when I learned how to mop at Ohio Street, that, like, that was going to be the thing that, like, I thought about for years to come as something special to me. That probably sounds so lame if you're new, but, like, I came here with no purpose, no value, no feeling of worth, no direction, no nothing, dying of something that I could not name, and you named it for me. And then you gave me a solution to it that I wasn't even really looking for, right? Like, I came here with all the wrong motives. I went to treatment because I wanted a break from life. I went to AA because I wanted a break from treatment. I got a sponsor because I wanted my car back. And then I began to recover because I really wanted to show my ex how well I was doing. And instead, I endeavored to do the 12 steps, and I had a complete spiritual awakening that changed me on a molecular level. And the obsession to drink for me was removed entirely. I don't know when. I don't think it matters. But I think had I delayed in beginning my steps, I don't know that that grace would have been extended to me much longer. Because that really is what it was. Before meetings, before commitments, before sponsorship, before anything, that first week of sobriety was just simply grace. And there are still days, like today I was sitting at home, and like, I had just been laying out in the sun, and I came in and I was like, this is so silly, I don't know why I'm saying this right now. I was eating hummus and and like celery and carrots, and I was like, you know, this is a really good life, because it is. I should be dead. What I'll say is that, like, I finished my steps for the first time in the first 10 months of my sobriety. I began to be of service in meeting commitments, yes, but also through H&I, and then eventually general service, where, you know, I started not knowing what I was going to do, and then became a committee chair at the area level, and then became the chairperson of the area, and now currently serve as the alternate delegate of Area 5. I'm a signer on a bank account for Alcoholics Anonymous, which is dumb. Like, no one, I chose to live in a car to defend my drinking. You know, like, my parents didn't know where I was for months when I got sober. And people trust me today. And it is nothing to do with how great I am. I never want to stand at a podium and make it sound like I am some success through Alcoholics Anonymous, because Alcoholics Anonymous is the success through me. I don't know, whatever. But I've done nothing, you know, magical here. Like, I've just followed the person in front of me. I've taken direction almost perfectly the whole time. You know, I've done my best to be entirely honest, and I've had to kind of constantly surrender time and time again. I lived a really high capacity, service-driven sobriety for the first 5.5 years of my sobriety. And then at the beginning of 2024, I started working on Skid Row, and 3 months into working there, I witnessed the aftermath of a good friend of mine being shot, and it broke something in my brain that felt irreparable, and suddenly things were very difficult for me to do. Really innocuous, innocent things felt unsafe in life, and that included just getting out of the front door in the morning and trying to get back to work. And I did not know that through all those small yeses that we say in AA, that the big yes I'd be asked, you know, one day would just be like getting up and doing the day, but that became my reality last year in a big way. And all of a sudden, I wasn't able to operate at the same capacity I'd been operating at for years service-wise. And that was really scary, because that was the basis for my recovery. And at some point, you know, I'd abandoned my spiritual practice, and I thought that if I only perform well in AA, then I can wrest some satisfaction out of life. If I only do these things in AA, then God will give me everything I can, you know, ever ask for. And that's just never going to be the case. I can't play God with God. And, you know, it became very clear to me that I needed to rebuild my foundation in AA. And I started doing the 12 steps again with a sponsor, and I started building a new spiritual practice, and I started building a new relationship with God. And what I will tell you is that when I was new, what my prayers sounded like was getting up in the morning and saying something like, you know, God, Georgia tells me that you're there, and if you are, please keep me sober. Okay, bye. And then at night saying, okay, you know, big guy, if you're still watching, thank you, good night. And that is to say, you know, although amusing, it felt weird, and it felt clunky, and it felt awkward, and I didn't know that it would ever work, but I just did it not knowing if it would work or not, because it had seemed to work for others that seemed to know something I didn't know about me. And so I started doing it, and I'm really grateful for those flimsy prayers in my early sobriety, because over time, what it has built into, given this rededication in particular over the last, like, year or so, you know, my God, my personal God, and God I use as a term of convenience, so if it makes you uncomfortable, I understand, but it is not that God that you refuse to believe in, nor is it the God that you feel abandoned by. When I speak of God, it is a God that is personal to me that I found through AA. And if you're new, I implore you to do that as well. But like, it is the basis not just for my sobriety, but for my entire existence. My ability not just to live at peace with the world, but my ability to live at peace with myself. And you know, each morning I still get up and I read and I meditate and I pray, and a lot of my prayers have to do with the kind of person that I hope to be today. The kind of person that I hope aligns with whatever God's will is for me. And, you know, I have done none of this perfectly. But I have stayed here. I still go to 4 meetings a week, oftentimes more. I'm still, thank you, actively involved in general service. I sponsor women. I am sponsored. I am accountable and current with that sponsor. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the single greatest thing I've ever been a part of that I never wanted to be a part of. Like, I really thought that I'd come here and I'd garnish your tools and I'd walk away and I'd go on my merry way. And like, a day at a time for 6.5 years, that has never sounded like a good idea, you know, hell or high water. And that is through grief, that is through trauma, that is through heartbreak, that is through a lot of successes and celebrations and fun. Drinking has never, you know, at times it's appeared as a fleeting thought, but it's just never seemed like it would be either like a decent amplifier or a way to commiserate that would lead to anything but absolute destruction. And what you've given me here is like a life that I don't want to destroy. It's a life that where I've repaired relationships with people I did not want to repair them with. I'm a member of a family today that is dependent on and relied upon. And I didn't want that when I got here. My wish list when I got here was health insurance, going to the dentist, and like doing yoga every day. And two out of three of those have been accomplished, and I'll let you guess which ones. But like, I've been overpaid. That spiritual experience that I sought in alcohol, that profound alteration in my reaction to life, has been given to me here freely, as long as I remain willing to continue picking up the tools and using them, but most importantly, finding ways and endeavoring to find ways to pass them on to someone else. And that is really what's given me purpose here. And if you're new, I hope that you'll stay and take the entire journey, because you deserve it. Thank you for listening.